It's a very big distinguishing factor between, you know, white feminist practices, which are like, here's the game of patriarchy, here's how you game your way to the top, versus, you know, a lot of Black feminist movements, Latina feminist movements, indigenous movements in the United States, queer rights, trans rights, a lot of like working class feminist movements, fat activism in the United States. A thread that I trace through them is that they are challenging that system. They are not trying to excel within it. And that's the piece that has really endured with white feminism, is it doesn't matter who you exploit, who you step on, what you accumulate. It's a very individualistic way of viewing, interpreting, and a lot of ways enacting feminism.
Hello and welcome to the Feminist Mom Podcast. I'm your host, Erin Spar. I'm a licensed therapist, feminist, and mother of two. Join me and my guests each week as we chat about what it's like mothering in today's society. We'll point out the double standards mothers face and unpack the conflicting societal messages we receive. We'll name out loud how the patriarchy and other systems of oppression impact our experiences of motherhood. This podcast is for you if you appreciate honest and smart conversations that will validate your experiences, promote discussion, and empower you to mother on your own terms. Hello and welcome back to the Feminist Mom Podcast. Took a few weeks off for the winter break, and now I'm feeling excited, refreshed, and ready to share more amazing conversations. Today's discussion is a really exciting opportunity for me. It was really amazing to get to speak with Koa Beck. Koa is the author of the acclaimed nonfiction book, White Feminism, From the Suffragettes to Influencers and Who They Leave Behind. She is a recipient of both the Alan Jutze Fellowship at the Huntington and the Joan Shorenstein Fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy School. Koa lives in Los Angeles with her wife and foster children. Most recently, her essay titled Nanny of the State was published in the Massachusetts Review, where she details how gender mythology dictates who gets deemed a good mother on the state level, and how children are routinely and legally taken away from their families to be placed in homes like hers. So Koa and I talk about white feminism, the ideology that she traces in her book, and specifically how the conversations around motherhood can be sort of limited in certain places around kind of the interests of the individual on those with access to privilege, and how what we really need to be doing is focusing on collective liberation of intersecting forms of oppression and how they impact the experience of motherhood. So that's been a goal of mine, to make sure that I'm having conversations with mothers from different backgrounds, different sort of groups who have different interests, and to make sure that we are focusing on the collective. So this was, I think, a really important episode to listen to. I hope that if you haven't already, that you definitely check out Koa's book, White Feminism. There's a lot there where she does talk specifically about motherhood in a lot of the book. Also, she and I talk about her piece, that Nanny of the State, that was published in the Massachusetts Review, and brings up another really important topic that isn't often sort of well represented as far as the problem with the welfare system and the specifically the foster care system. So another kind of follow-up in addition to her article, which I will, of course, link here, is a book called Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. And that is by Dorothy Roberts. So if that's something that you want to learn more about, that's also a great resource, which I will link in the show notes. Here we go. This is Koa Beck.
Hello, I'm here today with Koa Beck. Koa, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you for the invitation, Erin.
Yeah. So this is a big deal. I know you from White Feminism, the book you wrote, with sort of the whole history behind kind of the feminist movement. You really have unpacked a lot of that and help us understand kind of the societal sort of ways that we think about feminism and how white feminism has sort of kind of taken over, I think, a lot of the way we think about feminism. So you have a lot of knowledge there. And I know you have a very impressive resume beside that. So why don't you kind of share, just kind of introduce yourself and also kind of where you are maybe in motherhood.
Sure. As Erin just said, I am the author of a book called White Feminism, From the Suffragettes to Influencers and Who They Leave Behind. She came out a couple years ago now, which I'm still wrapping my head around. The book came out in 2021, at the top of the year, so pre-vaccines. Which was a very, very particular moment to be publishing a book of any ilk. Prior to the book being published, I was awarded a fellowship from the Harvard Kennedy School to research the ideology and history of white feminism. Primarily what I wanted to do when I got the opportunity to do the book was to, one, offer a very enduring and historically anchored definition of white feminism. My career prior to writing this book, I was an editor in mainstream women's media, as well as I was the editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and I actually stepped down to write White Feminism and to accept the fellowship that made that book possible. Prior to that, I was an executive editor at Vogue.com, and before that, I was the senior editor at MaryClaire.com, senior features editor, excuse me. So I had spent a lot of 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018 in these big newsrooms that were very women focused and focused a lot on that particular moment within national discourse on women's rights. And so I covered Women's March and I covered, Trump's ascension to office. I covered a lot of gender issues broadly and specifically, you know, the decline in abortion rights, abortion access before Roe v. Wade. And something I started to see probably in the middle of my career was this sort of lobbying of the term, you know, white feminist or white feminism in discourse, you know, particularly on social media, but also in, you know, op-eds and pieces in which, you know, different people, different marginalized genders were debating and in some ways analyzing women's issues. And this was, you know, on the rise of, you know, Lean In and this very like corporate feminist movement in which feminist causes, even the word feminist was being used by top female CEOs, business owners, people who, you know, maybe a couple generations before wouldn't have necessarily been deemed feminist because of their embrace of a lot of sort of capitalistic values. And even on top of that, you know, women who wore makeup, women who wore lipstick, women who were, you know, very conventionally gorgeous. It's a real moment in time to consider that, you know, when I was coming up in newsrooms, not that long before, feminist had been a real dirty word in pop culture. And it's easy to forget that now that there, and I cite them in my book, you know, a number of very visible, powerful women who would sing and write about you know, however they envision empowerment or, you know, being women of influence, women even having a lot of money, when they would be asked publicly about, so do you identify as a feminist? Do you use that word? They would absolutely shun it. And the tonality that often came across in, you know, these interviews, if you remember these profiles, was like, no, you know, I'm not a feminist. I wear a leotard. very simplistic definitions, and what, you know, a lot of these powerful women in retrospect, when you look at their interviews back to back, you know, a lot of what they are toying with and dancing with in real time is like, no, you know, I'm desirable and I'm sexy and I'm not a feminist. And you can detect in their tonality this holdover of sort of it's untrue and stereotypical, but, you know, like lesbian, man-hating, bra-burning, hairy armpits kind of thing, which some feminists are. So it was a real moment in time for me to be covering women's issues, and then, you know, having covered that environment, then start to see a real shift where, you know, Beyoncé had the term feminist behind her on stage at the VMAs, which hadn't really been seen from a pop star of that, let's say, like, scope and influence, somebody who's that mainstream, to the point where, you know, in newsrooms, all of a sudden we could put feminist in a headline. Like, there was a very big influence of like, oh, now we can talk about feminism openly in mainstream discourses. And that was a huge shift. Now, what I started to notice, you know, being very earnest and having, you know, gone to a women's college where, you know, we read Judith Butler on the floor of my professor's homes, was, you know, I was very excited by this. And yet in real time in my 20s, I started to see that, you know, when I said the term feminist, you know, to talk about, like, you know, affordable housing or, you know, poor women being able to afford diapers, things like that, it wasn't exactly translating in this, you know, hyper celebration of mainstream feminism, where, you know, I'm talking about those issues. A lot of the women I was working for or reporting on, when they said feminist, they were actually talking about, like, running businesses and accumulating a lot of capital and, like, buying a lot of things. And it took me a minute in real time to realize, oh, like, we're interpreting feminism in entirely different ways. And that's where the term white feminism came in, which I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners probably heard or saw in some respect, where you have these, like, very, very privileged women who are basically dictating this very narrow definition of feminism, in which everyone aspires to go to Vassar, everybody runs a business, everybody has, like, in-home, you know, help with their kids and, you know, cleaning their kitchens and stuff like that. And everybody's, like, wealthy. And for, you know, a lot of marginalized genders, feminism is, you know, rights for domestic workers. It's like having access to healthcare. It's, you know, having a secure place to live, specifically as, like, a trans person, job security as a queer person. So these are two very different realities. And that specifically led me to not only want to put a definition on white feminism, but also to show how enduring white feminism as an ideology has been in the United States. And while I had my, you know, suspicions based on things that I had read, you know, feminist texts I was aware of, when I wrote the book, I could really see, you know, through the 1920s, how this ideology of white feminism has endured. And in a lot of ways, you know, it's not very creative. It's stayed the same. Yeah. It's really anchored in, you know, not meeting women and other marginalized genders where they are in terms of their needs or, you know, systemic disadvantages they come up against gender. It's about being aspirational and aspiring to be a certain type of woman, usually a woman who's white, usually a woman who's able-bodied, usually a woman who is straight, usually a woman who's cisgendered. It's not really anchored in real circumstances, and it never has been.
Right, like, from, like, the time of suffragettes to, like, Lean In, sort of, like, it almost feels like it's, like, the same thing, only maybe sort of rebranded, modernized. Would you agree? Is that Is there a difference?
Very much so. Yes, very much so. Yeah. And I was, I didn't expect that, you know, when I went researching, I was very earnest in my research and trying to gauge not only how long white feminist ideologies and practices have sort of dominated feminist discourse in the United States, but also how the parameters are the same, even as the language evolves. I trace white feminism from the sort of beginning-ish of the 1900s through the present day. And just like you said, Erin, like the things that, you know, Sheryl Sandberg is espousing in terms of, you know, here's how you climb this system. Like, here are the concessions you have to make. Here are the things you have to do. Middle to upper class white suffragettes were saying the same thing in their time. And it's a very big distinguishing factor between, you know, white feminist practices, which are like, here's the game of patriarchy, here's how you game your way to the top, versus, you know, a lot of Black feminist movements, Latina feminist movements, indigenous movements in the United States, queer rights, trans rights, a lot of like working class feminist movements, fat activism in the United States. A thread that I trace through them is that they are challenging that system. They are not trying to excel within it. And that's the piece that has really endured with white feminism, is it doesn't matter who you exploit, who you step on, what you accumulate. It's a very individualistic way of viewing, interpreting, and a lot of ways enacting feminism. Whereas, like, you know, these other movements I've just cited across time, they're not necessarily looking at, you know, a particular woman in their community and thinking like, well, how do we all be like her? Because, you know, she has a really together family and like her children are well taken care of. And, you know, she has secure food in her house. The a lot of those other movements, they look around and think, well, how can everybody get access to this resource? Yeah. And white feminism has never been engineered that way.
Right. White women have been in a position of having like proximity to power via white men. Right. And so it kind of makes sense, like just thinking about how like their hierarchies work, how we like stratify among the different sort of ways that we can have be a, an oppressed group versus having power. Like we tend to, folks who are, you know, in between, right, the sort of like more powerful group and the sort of more oppressed group try to sometimes step on the people below them to get to the top, right? And so that's a very fair criticism of just white women in general throughout history, right? We see that white women have weaponized their whiteness even while being oppressed by men. And it's an interesting kind of position to be in. But what you're talking about is actually feminism isn't really just about empowering women. It's about liberating everyone.
And being a collective rather than an individual. That's an enduring mark of white feminism, is that when you're disenfranchised because you're a woman, you know, whether that's like, you know, you work at a white collar job and you're, you know, pregnant and they put you on the quote unquote mommy track and just try and like funnel you out of the company, or whether, you know, you have been sexually harassed, you know, within your job, white feminism down through time has asked you to turn inward and be like, okay, well, how do I optimize myself? How do I optimize my circumstances? How do I change this for me? Which, generally speaking, in terms of, you know, how these structures operate, especially, you know, oppressive ones, corporate ones, whatever, if you have gotten pregnant and are, you know, funneled into a different avenue of your job because you're expecting, that's probably happened to other people where you work as well. These things are not siloed at all. And so to look to your left, look to your metaphoric right, and to work with other women, other marginalized genders who are also under the standard. That is something that white feminism has not advocated. It's you're supposed to be very self-interested and you're supposed to protect yourself. And, you know, that includes even in terms of like organizing and, you know, activism, pushing for different policies, whether it's, you know, in your immediate workplace or even legislatively, not just thinking in terms of, you know, the other women who work and live like you do. You know, what about the women who come in and clean that office after everyone has gone? It's a pretty obtuse and literal statement, but those are women too. And
of course,
white feminism, you know, has really internalized and in some ways like anchored in that very capitalistic understanding of like other women as resources. And you see this a lot with like, you know, childcare, because, you know, we don't have access to things like universal childcare in the United States. Childcare is a nightmare to navigate as a parent and especially as a mother. And so, you know, the use of, you know, underpaid immigrant women as a way to solve your own immediate needs, to, you know, potentially exploit those women, to not give them paid time off, to have them work at such a pace where they can't see their own families. You know, white feminism has incentivized that. And has, you know, developed a whole language. I mean, think about, I remember when I was working in newsrooms, you know, the term outsource. I remember that coming up all the time in terms of work-life balance and like having it all and stuff. And this idea that you outsource things, you outsource, you know, the cleaning of your kitchen, you outsource childcare, you know, all sorts of like running of errands, taking care of elders. And, you know, when you do that, you invisibilize probably the woman who is doing that care for you, because she's not even a person at that point. She's just like how you fulfill a task, usually exploitatively, but not always. So white feminism has been very complicit and actually encouraged women to think of other women down through history as a means to an end, as a resource that is there for you to exploit.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, what you're talking about with the sort of access to support. We talk a lot about in the sort of maternal world, we talk about the village, right? This like missing, talk about interdependence, talking about community. There's a lot of us that we all want that. And often I hear this as the solution is, well, then you need to pay for your village. You need to, but who has access to that? Who can actually do that is sort of what you're talking about. And, and so like we talk about, right, in more progressive sort of spaces, this, okay, we shouldn't be looking through this white feminist lens. And instead we needed to have an intersectional feminist lens. I'm curious kind of just your thoughts about how we're using that, what you notice in kind of feminist spaces with people trying to be more intersectional.
Well, I'll tell you what doesn't work, and then I'll tell you what does. And this is an anecdote I've used before because it came up a lot in my career. When I was an editor at different, you know, women's publications, especially covering, you know, overtly feminist issues, I was editing a lot during the Me Too movement after it was reawakened, Tarana Burke. I was on a lot of panels about, you know, how to report sexual harassment and sexual assault. Also a lot to do prior to that, you know, like pay equity, you know, different like feminist issues broadly. And a lot of times what I would see would happen on the back end is that I would be invited to a panel that was explicitly feminist in terms of like the topic, what I'm discussing with, you know, other journalists or, you know, activists or what have you. And the topic would be set, and then they'd reach out to me, a few other women. And then, you know, at the very last minute, once everything, you know, was finalized and the logistics were put together, somebody would realize that, oh my God, there's no trans women on this panel. Or like, oh wow, we only have you know, one person of color on this panel, which would usually be me, but not always. We don't have any Latinas on this panel. We don't have any immigrant women on this panel. We don't have any disabled women on this panel. You know, it you can drop it in. It's like a fill in the blank kind of thing. And, you know, at the last minute, they would pluck, you know, say like a Latina and just sort of like fix her on the panel and be like, there, we did it. You know, it's now a diverse panel. And I saw this happen so many times in, you know, email threads that I'd be CC'd on. I would be asked to, you know, suggest somebody. And how that's a miss is that the thing is, if you start at topics, you know, that cut across a lot of gender and race and experiences of like orientation and, you know, class, you will get a diverse group of voices. You know, what say like a single Black mother has in common with maybe like a white trans woman in this country right now is that it's very hard for both of those groups to find safe and affordable housing. That is something that they share because of the way patriarchy and misogyny views both of them and racism. So if you start at basic need, and I lay out very cleanly what that is, you know, in the book, if you're operating from a place of affordable housing, food security, access to clean water, you know, healthcare access, it you will get a diverse group of people who have experienced this in different ways. It's only when you, I've noticed in my lifetime, when you narrow down, you know, feminist discussions to starting at like lofty educational opportunities and then like business and enterprise, which a lot of times is where white feminism starts. White feminism now and 100 years ago never has started at basic need. Mostly because a lot of those women have access to the things I've just cited. They have secure places to live. They are secure in their food. They have access to clean water. They have some healthcare access, depending on if they conceive and carry kids or not. And so it's very revealing in terms of what is a white feminist space from the jump and what is not. And that if you're just talking about, you know, running businesses and having like feminist minded enterprises, yes, you're going to get a lot of middle class women, mostly who are white, but maybe not always, and who are reflective of exactly that conversation. Whereas if you start at basic need, things that, you know, people across gender experience hardship for and who come up against a barrier because of their identity, because of their culture, because of how they're oriented, because of their gender presentation, you will get a much more rich discussion space. But that becomes complicated when you factor in, say, like brands and corporations, right? Because a lot of times that's not their aim. They just want to sell things. So, you know, bringing in people who are from middle-class backgrounds, who have disposable income, who can sit at like a fancy, you know, feminist branded conference and, you know, buy March on lipstick by Elizabeth Arden, which is real. That speaks to like a very specific aim.
Well, yeah, it sounds like it's less meaningful. It's less revolutionary. It's actually, right, to sort of, you know, put lipstick on something that only applies to a small percentage of marginalized genders. So, yeah, in kind of taking what you, like the work you've done, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think a lot through this like metrocentric feminist lens, right, looking at how the feminist sort of overall movement, right, maybe has like left out mothers, right? In a lot of ways, you know, women who've had access to privilege, let's say white women in particular, but other women who maybe have like, you know, higher socioeconomic status could kind of, right, achieve more power through not having kids, right? Like for a while, it was like you could go to work and, right? And so there's this place now where like it's sort of we're looking at motherhood and saying, wait, like a lot of mothers feel left, sort of left behind. And also I see, it's interesting what you said about like kind of being a part of the sort of more global community. When I've been asking mothers through these interviews and in general, like what their experience was, a lot of them have been telling me that they actually felt more connected to other mothers, to the sort of global community from becoming mothers, like sort of in that transition. So it's kind of an interesting intersection. Obviously, we have lots of different kinds of mothers. But I guess I'm curious kind of how you think about the intersection between sort of white feminism and discussions around like what the motherhood issues, right? Like paid parental leave and like you said, childcare. Like what are your, just sort of where does that take you? What thoughts come up?
I have many thoughts on that, and they are in the book. I spend a great deal, and it was very important to me to explain this for exactly some of the reasons that you underscored, where, you know, a number of women specifically who may have, you know, followed white feminist practices unknowingly, or, you know, came to feminism through a white feminist lens, once they became mothers, they saw how limited that ideology was even for them, you know, having maybe advantages based on race or class or ability. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that is that, you know, even for, I think, you know, women who are more privileged in this country, caretaking is not factored into white feminism at all. And I really saw that thread even from white feminism's origins, in terms of even, you know, in the 20s, there are records of, you know, these very prominent, again, aspirational, white, thin, conventionally gorgeous women talking about feminist issues. And it's not really about, you know, supporting care work. The legislation that they are pushing for, what they are advocating for, it's not like, how do we get more recognition, specifically as mothers in this country? How do we get support for our families in terms of, you know, resources for our kids, you know, more time, any support with breastfeeding, you know, things like that. It's about getting into other public spheres. And then once again, getting other women in the home to take over that work so that they can then, you know, participate in politics, they can participate in commerce. And again, you know, there's, it's not like that was introduced with like support for those women who are coming in and doing this very essential labor for a family. That's a piece that white feminism has been very consistent on. And it's a differing sort of strategy from, again, like other forms of feminist thought, ideology, activism that I cite in the book, in terms of, you know, like I had to go to, for my job, for instance, a lot of feminist branded conferences. And every time I went to one of these, you know, I never, ever heard there be any sort of panel or like breakout room discussion on like, hey, how do we provide 401ks and sick days for our nannies? How do we do that? I never saw that ever. There, you know, there wasn't even any recognition or sort of acknowledgement of the domestic workers who make a lot of that travel for those particular women, those very affluent, visible women, possible. Those women don't exist in white feminism, and in a lot of respects are not deemed, quote unquote, the women we're talking about at all, which is one of white feminism's, you know, most glaring omissions. But getting back to my earlier point, white feminism, one thing that that ideology inherited and really took in wholesale from capitalism was a complete disregard of caregiving. Caregiving, whether we're talking about like elders, child care, special needs siblings, you know, these things do not generate money, and therefore are not deemed important. And there are so many instances that I've documented in the book where, for, you know, what some people call like fourth wave white feminism. So, you know, the kind of like lean in, you know, sort of like girl boss hustle culture. being in a position where you can even like decide whether to be a mother or not, to be a parent, it kind of rubs up against a lot of white feminist messaging about like work as much as you can, accumulate as much money as possible. This mm-hmm. is the marker by which, you know, you are not only deemed a feminist, but you are deemed like a successful feminist. And, you know, choosing mm-hmm. to get pregnant, to have a child, in a lot of ways contradicts those messages. And I have in my book, you know, documented instances where I personally had to edit a number of personal essays, all kind of the same ilk of like, you know, I'm this really successful woman and I don't have student loan debt anymore. And like, you know, I have a stable partner and like, should I really get pregnant? Like, like question mark, you know, and it's, you can see a lot of the, you know, severe messaging of white feminism kind of being turned over in these like young women's heads about like, I want to do this. And yet it goes in direct contradiction to all of this quote unquote feminist messaging, which, you know, for somebody like me with, you know, my background and, you know, what I've researched, you know, raises more questions than it answers.
mm-hmm. You don't have the answers?
I have some, but in terms of like, a consistent question that I've been across, you know, since the book came out that I'm asked a lot is like, how do you, you know, shoehorn basically like caregiving and being a parent, you know, back into like feminist practices and feminist ethos? To which I say like, well, what feminism are we talking about in the first place? Because, you know, like Black feminism, a number of like working class feminist movements, Latinx, I mean, that's foundational to how they think about feminism.
Yeah.
It's not something that they have to like figure mm-hmm. out a way to put back in the conversation. So that's something to consider in terms of like, how are you coming to feminism in the first place? I spend a good portion of the book explaining this concept called feminist economics, which if you and your listeners are unfamiliar, I go into it in my book, but there's a lot more you can find about it. It's a really interesting thought process that came about in the 80s in the United States, in which, you know, a number of feminist identified economists were like, well, they observed that like the foundation of the economy in specifically the United States, but I think you could say like Western world broadly, you know, doesn't factor in caregiving. And so when we're talking about like the economics of a household, say, you know, the time that generally speaking, a woman spends doing dishes, cleaning the bathroom, making dinner, taking care of kids, making bottles, doing laundry, these things are not factored into basic econ. And so mm-hmm. there are different schools of thought where different economists have invented something called feminist economics, by which they actually do think about the labor of the home and factor that in. And then within that, there's like a lot of differing opinions on like if you should even do that and, you know, assigning monetary value or whatever. But that's not even, I think, what's important. It's just if you look at our families, our households, you know, the things that the labor that, again, you know, so many women and men, but mostly still women do in this country, it is not factored or considered in the basic economy of our lives. Mm-hmm. And that's really reflected, you know, in our nation as well. You know, the fact that we don't have paid parental leave, the fact that we don't have universal childcare, the fact that we don't have really decently paid like mat leaves, even, you know, we're talking about like people who are carrying kids and then maybe have complications and need to go on bed rest. I mean, mm-hmm. the sad and unfortunate thing with capitalism that is really enduring and that a lot of people have said before me is that it doesn't treat us like humans, you know, it treats us like machines. And mm-hmm. so when we do have birth complications, when our children need us, when our parents need us, when we have, you know, special needs siblings that need us, the basic framework of our country does not acknowledge that. And therefore, the brunt of that often falls to women to pick up that slack and to be the exploited yes. labor, whether it's you or another woman you hire.
We're all making widgets in a machine. We're just like cogs in a wheel. This is like capitalism. It's how it works. And it's really, it's pretty bleak, right? To be like, because, yeah, a lot of the things that we want to change about our culture that would affect the quality of our lives, they're seen as a threat to the bottom line, which is like, kind of like the sort of main goal in businesses and our culture. And it's really hard, and we have to like untangle all of these systems, right? So I don't know if we'll solve that today, but I guess I'm curious in sort of thinking about what you feel like has been left out of the conversation around, like, in topics around motherhood. I know you and I talked ahead of time about kind of your experience in sort of understanding the foster care system, like in white feminism, in the way we talk about motherhood. We're not usually talking about kind of, we're talking often about, yeah, like sort of maybe a stay-at-home mom, or maybe a mom who went through a traditional way of, you know, becoming a mother. And so I'm curious, like, that feels like a role that doesn't get a lot of maybe visibility. And so I'm curious if you want to share about that.
Definitely. I think that's true in terms of like how motherhood, it has down through time been depicted in white feminism, has been very narrow, but also plays to a lot of respectability politics. When I was researching white feminism and, you know, pulling a lot of like archival suffragist material, a lot of these, you know, middle to upper class white suffragist groups, they literally designed what a feminist looks like in-house. Like, they decided on an image together and designed it, and then exported it en masse. And you better believe that was a very specific woman you were supposed to think of when you were thinking of like feminist causes, or if we're talking about like, you know, the specifically what was on the table in the 1920s, the right to vote. So they were very strategic in terms of like, here's the woman you should be thinking about when you're thinking about extending the right to vote. You're thinking about a white middle-class mother who is young, she's thin, she's conventionally gorgeous. She is not challenging, you know, who you think a mother is. She's not challenging who you think a woman is. This could be your daughter, you know, very like playing to the power of the dynamics. And it was very powerful. A lot of material I pulled from that time for the book, it's really homogenized, like the type of woman that we're, you know, supposed to think about when we think about suffrage. And again, you know, they're not pushing for like, you know, here's a lower class woman who is struggling to feed her kids and doesn't have access. You're not supposed to think about her. You're supposed to think about this rising, like upwardly mobile middle class woman who has kids who, you know, are lily white, just like her. And, you know, she is presenting children to you in a way that is familiar to you, and also raising them in such a way that you would condone. And I think part of that in white feminism very much is consistent, or is consistent with the messaging now around motherhood. You know, the assumption being that, you know, you have given birth, that you do have another partner with whom you're raising your children with, that you have a nuclear family, you know, with like, even if we are talking about a same-sex couple, you know, a mom and two kids. And, you know, increasingly data is available in this country that like so many families don't look like that anymore and haven't for a really long time. I'm a licensed foster mother along with my wife. And in our navigation of the foster care system, which, you know, I live in California. So California has the largest number of youth in foster care in the country. We're a big state, so that makes sense. But, you know, a lot of the kids who come through the system, thousands and thousands of children, you know, ultimately they're adopted by grandparents or, you know, aunts and uncles or, you know, somebody else in their family takes over the long-term parenting in the end. And so increasingly, you know, aside from just people who don't really subscribe to these very limited, arguably heteronormative ideas of family, it's just not reflective of where a lot of families are. And also considering, you know, with foster care specifically, one of the biggest resources, I would argue, to foster care is grandmothers. It's grandmothers who are often stepping up and doing the long-term labor of raising kids, you know, having raised children of their own already, and are now raising kids all over again. And that's not, you know, that these versions of family that I'm talking about, even if you're, you know, removing biology, you know, very queer interpretations of family, you know, some people use the chosen family. These are all of these versions are not addressed or really understood or even advocated by white feminism.
Yeah. Why do you think the nuclear family has been so protected and so endorsed? I mean, that maybe that's a big question, but what are your thoughts about that?
100% respectability politics. A lot of what has propelled specifically white feminism in this country is this idea that, yes, you know, I'm a feminist, I'm for equal rights, but I will not challenge anything that you deem to be uncomfortable. And a nuclear family, mm-hmm. A mom, dad, and two kids of, you know, different assigned sexes, that is a very respectable, capital R, family model. And it doesn't challenge, you know, people's ideas about women or chasteness or anything to do with like economic structures or queerness or, you know, anything to do with, you know, class. Like, this is a family model that, you know, has been promoted and really supported through advertising, through, you know, government policies. And again, you know, increasingly, much like with the rest of white feminism, that is aspirational. That's not really where a lot of women are in this country in terms of like blended families, even choosing to have children at all, you know, maybe being someone's stepmother. It's really unrealistic for where we are and actually for like what a lot of parents and mothers and families ultimately need, not having a nuclear family structure. Because a lot of times, if we're talking specifically our country, that formula for a family has been used targetedly to shirk government responsibility. So if you think about like all the stigma, for instance, around like single mothers in this country, and you know, a lot of the rhetoric is like, well, you know, had you kept your marriage together or like kept a man, or, you know, there's a lot of like cultural aspects around that terminology, you wouldn't need welfare. You wouldn't need, you know, additional support. Meanwhile, I would just like to say as like a footnote to that, even if you are heterosexual and married, you know, to a cis man and you have kids, statistically, he's not really like that big of a support in, you know, if we're talking about like domestic labor. That data has improved over time, but it's like, you know, it's not stellar. Like, yeah. your life isn't it's perhaps not as dire as a single mother's, for sure, especially if we're talking about economic support. But again, it's a very pointed way for our government to be like, well, you did family wrong. And therefore, you know, a lot of the language around this can be very punitive and very individualistic, right, in terms of like, well, you failed in this capacity and therefore this is what you get. Food stamps, you know, not being able to buy your kids, you know, back to school shoes, you know, worrying about school supplies, not being able to afford diapers. You know, our country has a very, very long history of shouldering systemic failures onto an individual.
Yeah, it seems like the nuclear family, as you described it, really benefits men, right? We see that.
Very much so.
Men, yeah, right, are the ones who benefit most from marriage and continue to seek it out. And we see that women married to men tend to actually decrease their workload when they get divorced.
So yes, it's all very complicated. And I really appreciate how you break this down in your book. But just pivoting, I wonder if you want to talk a little bit more about your piece that came out about being a foster parent.
Yes. So thank you, Erin. So I recently published a piece in the Massachusetts Review that's called Nanny of the State. That is about specifically my experiences as a foster mother, and in particular watching ideas of gender and very middle class motherhood collide in a courtroom with namely women, but not always, you know, who are not middle class, who struggle with addiction, who are unhoused, who, you know, are domestic violence survivors. And I come at this from a place, you know, having covered a lot of gender issues in the United States, and specifically, you know, cases from time to time. I've covered domestic violence, I've covered sexual assault. And what was important to me in writing this piece is that, you know, our judicial system, I would argue, based on the court precedents on a number of issues, you know, doesn't see women, doesn't see marginalized genders, period, like across the spectrum of gender. And so to be a foster parent in a system in which, you know, parents do get their children taken away from them and then are presented with, you know, plans by which to, you know, quote unquote, reunify with them. It's been in a lot of ways puzzling for me to watch a system that doesn't see women in the first place, you know, doesn't see the ways in which they have to navigate, you know, getting away from their abusers, navigate addiction, navigate poverty, then tell them what a good mother is. Because as you can imagine, you know, these are very infused by class and race. And so to ask, you know, a young woman of color who has been, you know, struggling being unhoused and has navigated addiction and domestic violence to mandate that she suddenly operate on the level of like a middle-class white, you know, sober mother who's never been, you know, abused at the hands of a partner, you know, in like a really truncated window of time. And we were talking like months, you know, to then dangle her children at the end of that as, you know, an incentive, really sets a lot of these mothers, I would argue in my piece, up to fail. Because kind of like we were talking earlier, it really shirks responsibility in that, you know, she is tasked, I have witnessed, she is tasked with this by herself. She gets some government support and some assistance in terms of like trying to get out of her circumstances. But what I mean is like the responsibility is deemed hers and not necessarily a standard of living that is becoming increasingly inaccessible to people just like her. And, you know, more people who are not like her. And so to have covered what I've covered, to be aware of the judicial system, you know, on this level, and then to, you know, go to court and watch the way that these women are treated, especially when you consider, you know, all the narratives around, you know, quote unquote, people deserving to have their kids taken away from them. For your listeners, you know, if you have heard this or, you know, you have participated in this, I deeply urge you to rethink statements like that, because our country has a very, very long history of taking, namely, kids of color, Native kids, especially in the United States, away from their parents. And then, you know, telling both children and parents that it's for their own good. And this has a lot of really deep racial implications and racist implications. And there's also a lot of, you know, privacy and secrecy around foster care cases because they deal with minors. And so it's not really something that people can speak about very openly, you know, for a lot of legal reasons. But primarily what I wanted to draw attention to in publishing my essay is to align this, you know, in a narrative of women's rights broadly. Issue that Nanny of the State was published in is the 50th anniversary of a issue just called Woman that actually published some really important pieces by Angela Davis and Audre Lorde and Anais Nin. And so the Massachusetts Review is in a lot of ways like revisiting those same questions 50 years later. And it was really important to me as somebody who was asked to participate in the issue to align mothers, and specifically mothers who have had their children taken from them from the state, as part of this long-term interrogation of racism, motherhood in the United States, classism, and also just state surveillance. I am not, you know, one of these women who has had their children taken from them. I take care of those children. But the level of, you know, surveillance that my wife and I have agreed to, you know, to be a part of the system is something else I also go into in the essay, in terms of, you know, we have social workers in and out of our home all the time now. Our family is scrutinized, you know, on both a state level, but also on a personal level, in order to have children in our home. My wife and I literally had to get a license to have kids. And the piece of paper itself, I mean, it's so much led up to us getting that. But and it's a very important document. But having said that, you know, when I did finally get it, it's like a piece of paper you'd get from like the DMV or something. It's not like a very, you know, like beautiful document, you know, when you envision like a license to have children. But, you know, in order to achieve that, my wife and I had to be fingerprinted. We had to have background checks done on us in multiple states. We signed consent forms, basically giving the state access to all of our medical records should they want it. This includes therapy, any, you know, specialized like psychological evaluations that we may have had. We also had to take classes on sort of developmental psychology, how developing brains respond to trauma, prenatal drug exposure, things like that. And just the level of scrutiny that has come into us being a family and deciding to have children this way is very extraordinary. And in some ways, I feel like, you know, all mothers, in my estimation, are judged brutally in terms of their parenting or their bodies or, you know, their capabilities based on class. And as a foster mother specifically, I feel like my wife and I are now occupying our own lane of that, where like, yes, we are judged literally on paper in reports that go to a judge that other people read. And so it doesn't leave, you know, a lot of margin for error, honestly. And I'm a first-time mother. This is how I've become a parent. I do not have biological children and I don't want any. And so, you know, I've become a mother through being a nanny of the state, which is very loaded and a very specific, like, unique way to become a parent.
I feel like I'm just like taking in all of that, just sort of feel like you're sort of pointing at many different sort of like, yeah, positions sort of here. Like I'm thinking about like the mothers you're talking about who, rather than investing in them and their success, even just thinking about like how much investment they're putting into training and teaching and prepping foster parents, like what would that be like to sort of invest in the parents who are often really just like, right, I imagine poverty would solve, like if we could, you know, give people a living wage and a safe place to live, that would probably like prevent so much of this, like, yeah, like displacement that then these children and parents go through.
Well, and per your point, I think it's worth raising a big misconception about the foster care system that I actually learned, you know, through my classes with my spouse was most children in foster care are not removed due to physical abuse. That's actually a really small percentage of cases. The biggest reason that children are removed is quote unquote neglect. which in my state, I can't speak to other states, but in my state, neglect is quantified as, you know, not providing enough food, shelter, hygiene, not taking kids to the doctor. It's basically, if you've ever struggled with, you know, a basic standard of living, you hit all of these things. And that's why most children in my state are removed. And per your point, exactly, you know, we're getting all of these resources to understand and also to like support these kids. And yet, you know, a number of cases that I've been aware of as a foster parent, you're basically talking about parents who are being punished for being poor. Their only offense, right? And then, you know, once they do get dragged into court, they are tasked with, again, on their own as individuals, like somehow not being poor. It's incredibly backwards. And also, like, it is a level of state violence that I have certainly read about. I have interviewed other people who have experienced state violence on this level. This is the first time I have experienced, and I would argue, like, witnessed state violence on this level.
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word violence. I mean, there's nothing more painful and cruel than removing a child from a parent, especially for when it's no fault of their own. They're already suffering. And we definitely have been seeing a lot of ways that our culture, rather than, again, because of capitalism, because of all the systems of oppression, rather than actually meeting the people's needs, we punish people for struggling. I mean, obviously, when we look at sort of like abortion, reproductive rights, it's like we're, rather than helping people like who want to be parents, helping them be successful, we're punishing them and saying, no, we use force, right? Which is a very sort of patriarchal, white supremacist like way of trying to make things happen through control, versus like, actually, what is the need here that we can meet? And it's very, very frustrating to witness. And it sounds like for you, being so close to the system, being in it right now, I mean, what is there some tension there for you about like even participating right in the system while trying to like, you know, change it or impact it, or, you know, what's that like?
I mean, tension is an understatement. wife and I talk about this a lot. There is a reason that, you know, much like, you know, police abolition, there's been a whole movement in the United States, and it's still ongoing, on foster care abolition, because it, you know, follows the same lines of like, this is a level of surveillance. This is policing families, mostly, you know, Black and brown families, who you think it is. And it does not necessarily yield family repair, which, you know, the juvenile dependency court system and DCFS, that's, at least in my county, that's what they, you know, claim to support up and down. So I'm definitely conflicted in terms of, you know, on the ground, my wife and I are absolutely needed in terms of like, these children need places to go immediately. Having said that, there's the more long-term, I would say, like, downsides to participating actively with our bodies in a system that polices and honestly severs families. Now, in a very, like, I would argue, like, isolated way, my wife and I try to, you know, function in a way that, you know, we come to the families who have had their children taken with a lot of respect, and we don't treat them, you know, like criminals or, you know, degenerates. We don't mirror that language of the court that is sometimes used with them. We're very communicative with them. We're very loving with them. You know, we've been in a position to do that, given how open these families have been with us. But I definitely have, in participating in the system on this level, I have larger plans of things that, you know, I might want to encourage other foster parents to consider, Also like more higher level things that, you know, as I go along as a foster parent and I learn more about the system and the children who are not in it right now, but the children who have been in it and have spoken very openly about their experiences of being in foster care. I've also been looking to, you know, other people who have reported on the foster care system. There's this really great book that I've started reading called Torn Apart, which is about pretty much what I just said. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, tearing apart specifically Black families and how the foster care system actively ruins the Black family. And so I have some longer term plans in terms of like conversations that I would like to raise, you know, having worked with these families, but also worked in the court and then, you know, being a caregiver on this level. I think having the skill set of being a foster parent, like literally on the ground, will better inform my bigger critiques of the system and how unfairly it treats families who are struggling.
Yeah, I Torn Apart is how I've heard about this and kind of learned through some other therapists who I know really moved by reading that book and kind of starting to see the foster system through this lens and encouraging abolition of the system or abolishing the system. So yeah, I think that's really important, relevant work. And this is like the dilemma right now is like working within systems while trying to dismantle them, while trying to change them. Like we're all doing that in different ways. Mm-hmm. And sounds like using your knowledge and experience to try to, you know, make change is really admirable. I'm looking forward to reading that piece, and I will link all the things we've mentioned, of course, in the show notes. I feel like I've taken like so much of your time. So thank you for going into depth and all of this. I'm curious, just in kind of maybe in closing, you know, any kind of anything practical that you found is helpful for moms who maybe identify as feminist, who maybe, you know, want to be sort of more move away from white feminism, like in practice. Any kind of takeaways you can think of?
I can think of a couple of things. One in particular that has really struck me as just like a personal anecdote, you know, in my own life is like generally speaking, I am new to motherhood myself. I was a nanny actually for a very, very long time and a babysitter. But so like taking care of children, child care, that's actually been like most of my life. But having said that, I am a licensed foster mother as of 2 years ago. So I'm new to the role of parenting. But generally speaking, you know, I don't really give advice to other moms because frankly, I think women get a lot of advice that frankly is unsolicited. I think mothers need policy and legislative support. I don't think they need like other women being like, here's a hack to like, you know, save five extra minutes. And I think that's been really the concession that white feminism has made for many years is like, well, you know, structural change is just too lofty to think about. So like, here's a personal hack to like, you know, get the most like right now. And that, you know, that's an artificial binary. That's like not true.
Yeah.
A lot of, and again, I learned this through researching white feminism, a lot of really important advocacy work and political activism has been propelled by mothers in this country. And like mothers who a lot of times, you know, don't have a lot of really pronounced political experience. They're just literally in positions where they're like, oh my God, I can't afford to feed my kids. This is outrageous. and they, you know, get together with other mothers and develop groups, develop strategies, stage walkouts, do nurse-ins, you know, like all sorts of things. There's incredible legacy of activism that has been led by mothers in our country. And the fact that like that has not been centralized in white feminism is very, very telling about the type of optics that are trying to be maintained within that movement. Having said that, you know, something that I've been very aware of as now a new mother in the world is, you know, when I'm out with my foster kid and, you know, I'm pushing a stroller and, you know, on 2 hours sleep and not really doing that great. You know, when I pass another mother, right, who's like also with her child in the stroller, and like there's this really cool recognition of labor that happens where we both look at each other and we understand literally the entire day. You know, nothing has been said, nothing has been exchanged, but we both see each other, you know, as people who are laboring, as people who are doing this very undervalued, underappreciated, essential labor of taking care of children and babies. And as something to, you know, leave your listeners with, that's very powerful when that's happened to me, particularly when like I'm not doing all that well mentally and like I have not really slept because, you know, the kid is teething and, you know, is up every 2 hours and stuff. And so to get recognition like that from somebody else who probably also spent their evening doing, you know, a version of that. That is a very important recognition that we don't have on the state and federal level.
Yeah.
I get that from another parent. And being able to harness that, to use that on a collective scale, you know, a lot of mothers who, indeed recognize like we are all laboring and we're all laboring under the standard that is unfair, that does not see us, that does not support us in either breastfeeding, in, you know, being able to afford formula in this country. I'm still reminding people that, you know, the formula shortage is still ongoing. It's really dropped off in the news, but it's very hard to find formula where I live. Not really much attention seems to be around that anymore. And it's, you know, especially given that our country does not have federal paid parental leave that supports breastfeeding, if that's even available to you. It's not, you know, for me as a mother, but because we don't have that, a lot of families in our country rely on formula because they don't have the parental leave infrastructure to be able to even prioritize breastfeeding, you know, assuming that they even want to. So, you know, these are a lot of ways that women and families are neglected in our country. And I would advise your listeners, you know, as you're experiencing, you know, these various ways of not being seen and your labor being underappreciated and undervalued, you know, there are other parents where you live, you know, who use the same public resources you do, who also have those experiences. And historically, what has really worked is you working with other women. You know, again, to put some space with white feminism, I strongly encourage you to not go inward, you know, to not say like, this really sucks for my family, and therefore, like, I need to figure out ways to hack my way into, you know, whatever. Really consider working with other women where you live, other women where you work, you know, other women who are caregivers and who are up against the standard, because it is against white feminism practices to work collectively and to have like really shared bonds and to think about how do we get this resource for all of us, as opposed to how do we mimic the person who has the resource.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's a great, great thing to sort of end on. I mean, that's sort of the village idea, is like we kind of need to create it together and include everyone in that. That's actually really powerful. And I am seeing that. I'm seeing, you know, like mothers kind of creating little like communes or single mothers who then say, let's like, let's live together and let's co-parent. And like, I think folks are realizing that that we can do that. And actually that's like, there's so much power there, but I agree with you around like hacks aren't going to cut it. We need the systems to change. And so I think that was a really good kind of balance. Like while we're fighting and advocating for that, yeah, like being seen, seeing each other is super powerful. So thank you for leaving us with that. Well, why don't we wrap up and can you tell us where folks can find you?
Sure. Like some people, I'm on the internet. So you can find me on the Instagram. It's just my name, at Koa Beck. I tweet less frequently these days, but I am on X as well as at Koalani, which is my middle name. And I have a website as well. If you want to flip through, you know, some of my selective reporting, it's just koabeck.com. And in terms of, you know, my book, White Feminism, I feel like if you are a mother, or you have participated in any sort of caregiving, you know, whether you're a grandmother or, you know, you're an aunt who is very hands-on with nieces and nephews, I feel like white feminism could be very applicable to you. And just your understanding of, you know, some of the concepts I raised earlier, like feminist economics and how white feminism has always abandoned caregiving and not factored that into feminist sort of experiences, but also struggles and blockades. And so, you know, I could say buy this book, but that's not really the language that I use. So you're welcome to do that, but you can also get it from your local library, which I do with a lot of books that I read. And I also read the audiobook as well. I don't know if your listeners have had this experience, but I was a very, very voracious reader before becoming a parent. And I still read when I can now, but it's I'm much more reliant on audiobooks now that I'm a parent. So if that is the way that you process information, and if that's easier for you, I read the audiobook as well, which you can also get at the library.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here, Ko. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation, Erin.
That's the show. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Feminist Mom Podcast. Thank you to my guest, Koa Beck. If you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to subscribe and leave me a review. You can also help support the podcast by becoming a paid contributor. Donate just a few dollars a month to help me bring these conversations to more moms worldwide. You can find me on Instagram at feminist.mom.therapist or on the podcast website, feministmompodcast.com. Until next time.